Thank you for joining us on our journey here to preserve the history of mixed martial arts. When I wanted to take on this project, I needed help. I brought in one of my favorite matchmakers, Miguel Iturralde, and the MMA detective, Mike Davis. So to do this, we've been able to preserve history. Welcome and enjoy.
Hey, Miguel Iturralde here, Lights Out Podcast. That's the MMA detective, Mike Davis, and we're back. Another deep dive interview. We have Chris Lytle waiting in the wings, and we are going to see about Seth Bagzinski, another Southwestern fighter, Mike, another guy with a lot of fights and some interesting stories from a deep hole there in the Rage in the Cage promotion. So what do you got?
Okay, so Rage in the Cage is kind of like, if you were to compare it to something, one, they've got a ton of shows. He's probably got like 400 or 500 shows under his belt. And you got to look at it kind of like if you were to compare it to a car, it's kind of like the Fred Flintstone mobile with his feet underneath it, just kind of making the car move. And the stories from there that I have heard, you know, just, you know, from the independent grind are pretty shocking. So I know we're going to talk about Cage Rage. We're going to talk about his Seth's relationship with Drew Fickett, as well as like we're dealing with a person whose sister was murdered and his brother is doing life in prison. And like, if you look at his trajectory, like from childhood as to where he's at right now, he's not supposed to be on either on this side of the grass or this side of the bars. So it's somebody that absolutely mixed martial arts has saved his life. And he seems like a real, like the few interviews I've seen of him, he seems like a very honest guy. And I think we're going to have a guy that brings his lunch to work, and he's going to tell us kind of from his view, his point of view, you know, what he experienced. I think it's going to be pretty good.
The Polish Pistola. Mike, where are you going to be this month?
Here I got, December 3rd and 4th, I'm at the Canterbury Expo Center in Minnesota. December 17th, I am in Chicago, 115 Bourbon Street, doing color commentary. And Tampa, Florida, Smooth Comp, please register for a jiu-jitsu tournament, February 5th. And with that, I am done. Please like, share, subscribe. We've got an affiliate now. We have affiliate code Lights Out at Diamond Sportsbook. It's betdsi.eu. If you like to gamble on a fight, they give you 50% cash bonus for your first deposit using our, using our promo code Lights Out. And please, 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 guys, like, share, subscribe. We're growing. We see it. We're going to break into that top 50 in terms of MMA podcasts very soon, as long as you guys, keep pushing our product, and it's greatly appreciated.
And here we go with the Polish Pistola. Hey, Miguel Iturralde, back here with the Lights Out Podcast. We got Chris Lytle on a run today. So we're going to get this started with the MMA detective, Mike Davis, and our deep dive guest, Seth Bagzinski, UFC veteran. Out of the very rugged Southwest scene, Arizona, New Mexico, that area and stuff. And we're going to get into it with Seth. Mike, what you got? And Seth, hello.
What's up, y'all?
All right. So the Arizona scene, it's so wide in regards to like MMA history. It's wide and thick and incredibly deep, but it all centers around, Rage in the Cage. And there's so many little hidden gems of stories from that area. And the only person we've gotten two people out of there. We've got obviously Joe Riggs, and we did Drew Fickett about a month ago. And Drew called me up the next day and he said, Seth Bagzinski's your next interview. Like he was like an order he was giving me. And
he waits for you to say like, yes, sir.
Or karate. I think you're supposed to respond with karate sometimes. That's like, yes, and Drew Fickett lingo. So we got the Polish Pistola. And the thing with Seth is I'm not trying to start too heavy on this interview, although it's going to get there. If you look at Seth's background, it is literally, I hope you've never heard of him because it's such a fascinating story. And if it's your first time hearing it, fantastic. But I truly believe mixed martial arts probably saved your life, Seth. Would you agree with that based on your upbringing?
I mean, I don't think about it all the time because I'm so busy with life. And I think a little bit is designed, even if subconsciously I do it. But every now and then someone asks me a question about, like, you know, I'll see somebody from where I grew up or a teacher or something. I saw this, my old teacher, Miss Loftus, and they always just sent me to resource because I was so dang crazy. I was such a problem. Teachers did not get paid enough to deal with me. And this, she was a beautiful person. Her name's Tanya Loftus, and I saw her at a game, and she said, "Hey, Seth, you know, I've been following your career." And I was like, "What's up, bro?" And she was like, "Did you ever think that you would go all the places and do all the things you've done? Did you ever really think that something like that would happen?" I was like, "Well, I was always pretty confident that if I put the work in, whatever I did, I could hit the outcome I'm looking for." And she's like, "Well, you're always very dedicated." And she's like, "You know, I've been a teacher for 35 something years." She's like, I'm a principal, and this job's never taken me anywhere." And I was like, "Holy smokes, man." Like, she'd given her life to that. And then here's this mongoloid just get to go do it, you know? And it really, like, on the way home, I was really like taken back by it and just thinking, like, man, like, you know, how lucky I am. And every now and then someone will say something where it's just like, you don't think about it because you're in life. But when you say it and you're on your ride home and the radio is off and you're kind of thinking, like, dang, man, like, how the hell did I end up here? And to some people, they would look at my life and just think it's a life. But it's hard for me to really articulate where I came from and who I was always told I was going to be versus who I am. And
I bet you there's a stark difference between those two.
Right. Cause I mean, I remember vividly being places and being in front of stores and like the way people would look at us. We were always the poorest people in every town we went to, you know, relatively close, but my mom and dad were good people, you know, like, I like to say that there were two people that were treading in water and they could barely stay afloat in the middle of the ocean and someone gave them five kids, you know, like it was hard. Yeah. It's hard for some people to get through this life, you know, and everyone has different battles. And I just remember looking at people like, "Why are you guys looking at me like that?" I would be looking around like, "Who are y'all looking at?" You know, and then when I realized they're looking at me, I was just like, "What?" You know, I'm just trying to get through my day or whatever. And
I think you guys were probably a rough house too, though. Like,
my brother's a sociopath, man. When I tell people my babysitter was a sociopath, they laugh. They're like, "You're funny," but I'm not joking. Like, you know, like, he's crazy. You know, it's crazy.
So, you know, your brother, who you just mentioned, is he doing time?
Oh, yeah. Currently? Yeah.
How long has he been locked up?
I mean, he's been locked up more than half his life. He's 5 years older than me.
Okay, so he's just kind of in and out. So I mean, and we're going to obviously circle back, but imagine if mixed martial arts was subtracted, like all that time that you spent in the gym or Friday and Saturday night at a fight, whether you were fighting or not fighting. If you made that free time, you'd be sitting next to your brother right now. I think it's fairly safe to say,
bro. It's insane. And I don't, like, bro, I'm so all the time I'll be driving. I'll like look at a sunset or something and just be like, you know, fuck, like so many people don't get to see.
Yeah.
So many people I know don't get to see that. And it's crazy. Like, I remember I had a real hard time getting out of high school when I got out, cause I was wanting to play pro football. And I felt I was probably better in my mind than I really was, but I felt that was pretty good. And I remember it was probably about 12th grade. I had this coach, Dan Ridgway, or not 12th of my junior year. So he was my coach all 4 years. He was one of my, he moved up with us in high school. He's a real cool dude. His mom was, his wife was in the school. And he was leaving to go to another school. And I was pissed. Like when I find out, I was pissed because he was like a big mentor. And when I, sorry.
And I don't think you listen to many people either. Do you know what I mean? I think you're a type of guy that you need to have respect for somebody in order to truly listen to them, because you're, you know, we're all hard-headed here. You know, like you need an example, like somebody. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, he was just like, absolutely. He was just someone that always took the time. You know, he always took the time to let me know, like, hey, well, it was always about adjustments. That's one thing my dad, even though he was always working all the time, you know, he would always tell me, like, no matter what, it was never like, you can't do this, or maybe you should do this, but it was like that. And I remember he was leaving, and he got a job in St. Louis. And it was already common knowledge to a lot of my teachers that I pretty much lived on my own. Like my dad had already moved out. My mom was moved out. I just pretty much like I had a spot, but they kept the electricity and the water on, you know? And it was very important for me to graduate high school. And I was so scared to have people find out that I didn't have parents, because I just the worst. For whatever reason, I was just so scared about going into CPS, like that, like having my whole plant life replanted. And I remember, you know, like feeling real sorry for myself. Some days, like I would, you know, on the weekends, if I wasn't hanging out with my buddies in town or something, I would, you know, I'd get real down on myself. And I remember just vividly, like, I don't know, it's like 16. I was like, you know, I'm going to graduate and I'm going to do something. And when Coach Ridgeway was leaving, I was like, everyone else was like, congratulations. And I was like, yeah, you're a bitch. And he was like, you know, he just started smiling, laughing, but he ended up asking me to move in with him my senior year. And I didn't do it. You know, I was just scared to leave where I was from. And I was so close to graduating. But
maybe a little embarrassed too, you know?
No, I was just fucking always on my own, and I was kind of used to it. And I was just so scared to leave what I knew. Who knows what it would have brought, you know? He's like, hey, we'll study real hard. We'll get all your grades. If you want to play college ball, I can get you into it. And I didn't do it. So then when I got out of school, I remember wanting to grow up so bad when you're a kid, you know? When you're a kid, you want to grow up so bad. And then you grow up and you're like, what the fuck? This is what I wanted to grow up for, to go to RTO Sullivan's and drink beer and everyone's gonna talk shit about each other behind their back. And it's just like the whole adult scene just was like very unfulfilling to me. And I was just looking for something. And then when I found MMA, it was like, I didn't give a fuck about any of anything else. Like I didn't care. Like once I fought, I got my ass kicked. I had no idea what I was doing, you know, and I couldn't wait to do it again. Like, I was just like, I don't know what the fuck that was. Like, I've never felt like that in my life. I was so nervous and scared. And I remember looking up in the arena.
Well, here, let's frame it properly. So your first fight, April 6, 2005, Rage in a Cage, a renowned promoter, Roland Soria. I'm sure he's one of your favorite people. We'll get to that in a minute, I'm sure. You fight Ryan Potter. Now, who were you training with prior to this bout taking place?
Nobody. I played basketball, football, ran track. I always told all my friends that wrestled. Two of my best friends were some of the best wrestlers ever went to our school and in Arizona too. And I used to tell them, when they'd be like, why don't you wrestle, dog? I'd be like, cause I play real sports. Like I can make the basketball team. You know what I'm saying? Like, y'all can't play any other sport, dog. And I was cornering my buddy Little B. He's like 4'11", and he's the definition of all heart. You know, when you see, oh, he's all heart, like that's my guy, right? That's my guy. I hear him talking in RTO Sullivan's, actually. I hear him yipping down the hallway to the security guards. He's like, yeah, I'm going to give him a fake and give him the Little B special. He's drunk, telling all the bouncers how he's going to knock this dude out. I'm like, man.
So he was drinking Thursday, that night that he fought?
Yeah, it's Thursday and he's fighting Saturday.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm like,
that. Okay.
I'm like, hey, dog, what are you doing, man? And he's like,
you still got Friday to drink, Mike. Come on.
Yeah, he's like, I'm gonna get down, Seth. I'm gonna give this to the Little B special. And I'm like, you're going home. Like, come on. And I was like, dog, have you looked at the guy you're fighting at all? And he's like, yep. And I was like, have you trained any kickboxing at all? And he goes, nope. I go, you know, he's a pretty good kickboxer, right? Like, how are you gonna close the distance? It was just like, I didn't know anything about fighting.
He's talking common sense. This is shop.
Yeah, just like
shop talk.
How the fuck is your vertically challenged ass gonna get inside without getting kicked inside the head? Pretty much, like, you know. And he goes, "Hey, can you corner me?" I'm like, "You don't even got nobody to corner you." Like
this is even getting worse. Yeah.
Yeah, I went down. I go down to corner him, and he gets annihilated. But he almost got him though, man. He just came up a little short, you know. He missed him, and he just head kicked him, dropped him, and gets back up, head kicks him again. I go in there, bro. He's like, hey, what happened? I said, or he goes, how'd I look? I said, not very good. He goes, all right. Didn't give a rip, you know. He was just doing it to have fun, and. That's the first time I met Roland Serra. He goes, hey, you're ready to fight. I said, I am. I didn't know what it was. I was just like, let's see what's up, man. And I
was the same night.
It was like 2 weeks later or something.
So Roland Serra had almost, he would throw sometimes events on a Friday and then in a different city on a Saturday. Like he has had months where he's done 10 different mixed martial art events.
He's like a used car salesman, but he's selling fighters.
Yeah. Okay. So here, bring us through.
But in a circus tent.
Okay. You just try not to step out of a clown car. You know, that's your main goal.
Yep.
So your first fight, Ryan Potter, you lose by rear naked choke.
Smashed. He just beat my ass.
Okay. And
what are you weighing at this point? Because a football player, you're probably blown up.
No, I was getting pretty fat there for a little bit, but I was trying to play pro football, so I was like 215, and then I started working out real hard, getting in shape. And I was just kind of around my natural rate. I was like 198, like 196-ish, you know? Okay. He wrestled a little bit too. Like, I think he was a 184 champ or runner-up or something. Pretty good. And I didn't know anything about MMA, you know, nothing. And I didn't know that back then they had open hand punches on the ground, which is good for someone like me. Looking back, I'm like, man, how come I can't punch people in the face? And now looking back that I didn't know anything, I'm glad nobody could elbow me and punch me until I learned a little bit.
Yep. That helps. So your first fight, you said you've got an incredible, almost euphoric rush. After the bout,
it was, I mean, I've never been scared to fight. Like, we fought our whole lives growing up. Like, put it this way, when I was a kid, I fought so much that I stopped telling people when I get in fights because they didn't believe me. Like, we fought every weekend. Like, every weekend, if we went to a different town and there was girls there, priority number one, girls. Usually didn't work out because we're all idiots.
Yeah.
Priority number two was we got to beat some dudes out in front of these girls. and it didn't go like that in your head, but like if there's dudes from another town, we're all giving them dirty looks. And we're like, what's up, dog? What are you looking at? Like, you know, what are you doing here? And they're like, this is our town. I'm like, no, it's not. Like, we were idiots. We fought everywhere. We would fight if there's no girls, no dudes from other towns, we'd fight each other. That's how stupid we were.
I don't think we, like, as men catch up to women maturity wise, probably to about our 30s. And especially then, there's a huge difference. There's a vast difference in maturity. Yeah.
I could still hang out with my kids all day. Like I'm hanging out with my friends. I could watch Lion King. I'm still a kid. You know what I'm saying?
All right. So August 6th is your first fight. Your second fight doesn't go well. You lose rear naked choke in the first round to Ryan Potter, obviously a very advanced high school wrestler. And your second fight is actually about that was supposed to take place a few weeks prior, but it was canceled. And it's against Robert King. You pick up your first win.
Yep. I open hand slapped him because we were open hand. So I gave him the old Nick Diaz. I gave him the Stockton slap back in the day.
Good.
And he was getting kind of shocked him, you know. And there was a lot of people there too. Like that was at Jobbing.com Arena, which is now Gila River. So like Roland used to give out 2-for-1. So like it was a big crowd, you know, because back in the day when we'd fight, like when I fought at Wild Bill's, there's like, you know, 3 boxing commission members. Like they're, you know, they're some of these crazy places you fight. There's not very many people there, but that was a pretty big arena. That worked out quick. And I actually trained with that. That guy came up and trained a few times. He's just an older cat, just looking to have a good time. And I got lucky, got a win.
So you're not serious about it yet. I mean, you're only like a month and a half in.
I didn't even know what it was. I knew I wanted to do it, but I had no idea how I was going to make it happen.
And so, you know, what was Roland paying you at this time for showing up with fights like this?
Nothing. But it was like those are amateur fights. So I wasn't planning on getting paid, you know, like I kind of knew that much. I knew that there's like a lot of gymnastics and there's a lot of like skaters and shit that pay to get in competitions, don't make money for a while, you know? So I kind of understood that part of it, but it was so new. There was no blueprint. Like nobody knew nothing about MMA, you know, like there was no, if you do this, this is going to happen. Like, nobody knew shit.
Let me ask you, because so all of a sudden, you know, you're an athlete, you're coming out, you know, you're a football player, you're a basketball player, you're confident in your athleticism. Sure, you'll fight, you get into a fight, you lose one, you win one. But Roland Saria, now that show's like on RITC 80. So there are people hanging around. Like, who's the first guy who came up to you and said, hey, why don't you come work with us?
He had to.
You know, it was You guys, there's a guy named Gilbert Aldana.
Okay.
And he was training there, and I liked him. This guy, Dave Connett, who's good friends with Roland. I'll probably get a call from him because I talk a lot of shit about Roland, but I'll talk shit in front of Roland. He was there, and we were training, and he was getting ready to fight in the UFC, I think. And we were pretty good friends. And I was always a tweener, you know, I'm 6'3". So I'm like, I'm not real small, but I'm not real big. So I was training with Gilbert Aldana. And then he had this boxing coach, Joe Leyva. He was from Tijuana. He went to Maryville High School. He's kind of rough dude, but he really liked me. And for whatever reason, he saw something in me. And he told me like, hey, he's called me Seffy. He's like, Seffy, let's every Tuesday and Thursday, you know, let me know what times you can make it. And I worked all day and I trained at night with the team. He wanted extra work, just doing bag work, because he had some boxing. So he came in every Tuesday and Thursday. I couldn't pay him for a while anyways. And he showed up every Tuesday and Thursday. I would work out an hour at the gym, 6:30 in the morning before I went to work. We'd do bag work and he'd put me through shadow boxing drills and just get me better. And I ended up being just kind of like a partner for him and getting Gilbert ready, you know? And he was just always telling me like, hey, Seffy, man, you got a lot of potential. Like, you know, he would always just kind of instill that little bug in me. And it wasn't really until like after Gilbert passed away tragically, and he was at the lake and I had a horrific accident and drowned. And
It's kind of a recurring theme in your life, man. You've lost a lot of people, and
I'm scared to make friends sometimes.
you know, truth be told, man, you absolutely, without fighting, are on the short list of something like that taking place to yourself as well.
Yeah, like I said, man, I'm thankful for every day I have, and I'm thankful for the life I have. Every day I try to have a little reset, even if it's for 15 seconds every day, and just appreciate what I got.
That's awesome. So from there, man, Shane Johnson, okay, Roland Saria is not doing you any favors with this fight. No. You're 1-2, and you fight the Battle Cat, Shane Johnson, and he lands, I mean, for somebody that's completely untrained, he lands a knee bar against you, which, I mean, it's got the recipe for absolute disaster of walking forever with a limp.
Listen, I knew so little, and he told me it's 2 weeks' notice. But in my mind, when you're 20-something years old, and you're living for the weekend, you know, my whole life, like where I'm from, it's like Daytona 500. There's mobile homes everywhere in the parking lot. Getting down, like it's for the weekend. Like you live one weekend at a time. And when he said 2 weeks, I'm like, oh, shoot, we got plenty of time, you know? He said he'd help me train. And every day I went in there early and tried to train with him. He never really helped me. It was just like the class or whatever. And, you know, when I took that fight, it was just the fight. You know, I didn't care. I really didn't. It wasn't like, it's like, all right, well, let's go see what's up. And then slowly, like every one of those fights, I'm like, all right, man, like you really need to, if you're going to keep doing this, like, you really got to figure something out. Like, this is not going to cut it. You're never going to get better here. Cause I showed up every day. I'd stay after I'd run. Like I did my thing, you know, like I tried to work with what I had, and I always did extra. Like I hung a punching bag in my yard. I didn't know how to punch, but I was working on it.
You had the outdoor gym?
Bro, I tried everything. Like
that's awesome.
I always been like that. You know, like when I was a kid, I like playing basketball. I'd shoot 500 baskets a day. You know, like that was my way to get away. Like that's what I did. You know, every day I could have the shittiest day or go home. And if I worked out, it was all good. So like, that's just kind of how, I didn't realize it was a coping mechanism at the time, but that's what it was, like sports. And so that's what I did.
Well, let's talk about your record as well. Like you're saying, these are amateur fights, but they're on your professional record.
Roland keeps going back and getting them put on there. I'm certain it's him, because I've had him taken off multiple times.
Okay, man, why is he doing that?
When I was in the UFC, I was like 12-5. I think 12-5 when they got in.
Yeah.
And they were off my record the whole time, but we had like call shirt August, like, look, these are amateur fights, you know, and they took them off. And then I started getting some calls from other places, you know, because I didn't have a real bad record when he took a lot of those amateur fights off. At that time, I had a winning record and a lot of finishes. And he was like, and then when I got out of the UFC this last time, I had a torn ACL. I was out for a while, and I was talking to Ray Steffo about going to Pro Fight League. And at the end of the day, they end up calling me at the end of it and saying, you know, it was your record, you know? And I was like, huh? My record? Man, fool, you know, like thinking, fool, you know what my record is. And then I was like, hey, dog, it's all good. Like, I understand that's a shitty job to have, to call people and tell them they can't, they're not getting picked to do their dream. So I said, hey, guys, that's all good, man. Don't sweat it. And then for some reason, I was like, my record, shit, I couldn't even remember what my record was. So I went and looked it up, and I was like, oh, shit, DBK had all those put on there again.
And, yeah, he put all these amateur fights, and they're clearly, I mean, they're obviously amateur just looking at the surface level.
3-minute rounds.
Let's talk about what I believe is your first professional fight with him. Miguel, this is fantastic. Rage in a Cage, March 18th, 2006. You fight a 265-pound Jonathan Toosie.
Yeah.
The native pit bull.
Yeah, he's cool, too. Hey, he told me he was around my size.
He's talking about Roland, he's the promoter.
Yeah, Roland. He goes, and this is my coach. So, like, this is one of them lessons where I was like, all right, well.
So Roland is your coach at this period?
Kind of. Like, I go to his gym.
Okay.
You know?
Fair enough.
I go to his gym. And I, you know, I'm coming from a place where it's like, yo, we're all a team. You know what I'm saying? Like, why would this dude bullshit me? So my sister's there, and this is in Fort McDowell Casino, I believe.
Yeah.
It's close to my hometown, the closest. So I had a lot of people there. And I'm like, shit, man. Like, John Tossi came up. There was him and this other dude. And I thought it was the other dude because he's about my size. Then when they told me to get on the scale, I'm like, I'm fighting that guy? He's like, oh, yeah, you got that. And I'm like, I was an hour or two from fight time. And I'm like, all right, whatever. So I'm just going to work too hard to just not fight now. I got too many people here.
Would you weigh in?
How he would do it, you know? He would get you committed and then kind of like manipulate you with that commitment, you know?
What was the weight difference between the two? He was every bit of 265.
I was 186 pounds.
You're talking like almost a 90-pound weight difference. Okay, well, the good news is that you, I think you won, you choked him out.
Yep.
Not an easy, I mean, the crowd must have went nuts when you see like a size difference between two opponents like that.
Yeah, yeah, no, it was pretty, he hit me with something too early too, because I had no defense, I still don't, but he hit me with something early. And it was like 30 degrees. It was like in December. I remember it being so dang cold. Warming up. I'd warm up and I'd warm up again, warm up again. And I remember going out there and I remember putting my hands on the cage and thinking, oh, this cage is gonna hurt so fucking bad when I get scraped up against it because it's cold, you know? I remember thinking that, like, oh, this cage is gonna hurt so fucking bad. Like when you hit your hand on something when it's cold. I was like, no. And it went good. But I remember that was kind of the point where I was like, man, I got to start looking for another place to train. But there was no avenues, really. You know, like there was.
ACF, what'd you get paid for that fight?
$35.
$35 total?
So he paid me $500 for fighting Shane Battlecat, right?
Okay.
So I thought, hey, he's like, you want to fight again? And I'm fighting at fucking light heavyweight. Is what he told me. And I'm thinking I'm getting another five. I didn't even think to question it because like he's my guy, right?
Yeah.
He gives me a check for $35. Joe Riggs is in there. Edwin Deweese. I didn't know none of these guys.
But Dan Lauzon is on the undercard too.
Yeah, there was like a bunch of fucking G's in this room. And I go, hey dog, I think you fucked up on my check. It's only for $35.
Yeah.
And it says like Warrior Cage Fighting LLC or something like that. And he goes, huh? And I showed it to him. He goes, who the fuck you think you are, Chuck Liddell? And hands it back to me. And I'm just like, I was in shock. Don't overreact. That's what I kept saying to myself. Like, don't fucking overreact. And I was like, all right, like, I see what this is now. You know, that was like the moment where I'm like, all right, you're not on my team. You're on your team. And I'm glad to know that now.
Okay. You know? So did you meet Drew Fickett that night? Because him and Lauzon are real close.
No, I ended up, I started bouncing around, like looking for a place to train. And I had nothing against ACS. I had never gone there, but
you're talking about Arizona Combat Sports, the Lally brothers.
Yeah, yeah. The Joe Riggs. Joe Riggs used to call him Pex from Willow. He's like, you little Pex. I always thought that was so freaking funny, dude. He's hilarious. And yeah, I didn't have anything against him. I didn't know him, but I just kind of wanted to get a place where I could have somebody, because I knew enough that I had a lot of building to do. You know, I had no wrestling, and it wasn't like, I'm not going to go ask a D1 guy that's getting his career ready to drill grade school wrestling shit with me, because it's hard enough just training yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. So I found Southwest MMA, and Santino DeFranco and Rich Moss had opened this little gym over there, and it was a little bit smaller, and I knew I needed some one-on-one time, like on the little odd nuances and kind of even like a theory. Like, I didn't even really have an idea how I wanted to fight. I know I wanted to stand up. I know that was I just wanted to be an exciting fighter. And I found that gym, and that's how I met Drew Fickett.
That's cool. That's cool. So you go from 2C, where you win by choke, and you continue to fight for Rage in a Cage, where you start racking up wins. You hit Travis DeGroat with a Kimura first round.
That's the first that he was – Drew was his coach.
Really?
And they went like 9-1 or something. And Travis he beat the piss out of me. I let him hit me until he got tired, and I choked that. Like, that didn't really – he was a really good wrestler, like zero wrestling. Like, a wind would blow, and I would fall over, you know, like – and Drew was in his corner. They had Efren Escondero was on that card. They had a bunch of really good guys, and they had a gangster little team. I remember I didn't know him or nothing, and I was kind of just fucking with Travis because, I mean, like – I ain't talking shit to be disrespectful, but just like fucking little goon games, you know? And I was like, hey, dog, we're staying out, getting ready to go out. And I go, hey, winner buys a beer, I told him. And he looked at me like, what? Winner buys. Like, whoever wins buys a beer. He goes, okay. And then I beat him. And like 2 years later or something, I seen him somewhere. He goes, hey, you owe me a beer, fool. I'm like, yeah, you're right. You're right. You know, but Drew knew Santino from ACS. They're both trained at ACS. And when Drew came back, like he came back from Oregon or something, and he was looking for a place to train. He got booted out of ACS already. You know, Drew's been kicked out of nicer places than this.
Dude, Drew has been kicked out. Miguel, tell him about Abu. We were at ADC's Abu Dhabi in Trenton, New Jersey, and Drew got sent home early. And we talked about it in the interview with him. Dude, that guy's a madman. He's a madman.
He's a savant. He's a genius.
But absolutely.
For 10 years I knew him, I had no idea when he was joking. And then I realized one day that he's always joking. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't laugh. Like, you don't know. Like, he'll look dead straight at you and be like, and he'll say something funny and walk off. And you're like, and he'll always wear his headphones. He'll go into places wearing headphones, but he never has them on just so people don't talk to him. he's my guy, you know?
Now, you obviously Drew's unique, right? But how do you feel at this point? Because, you know, you go from kind of training, you know, on the side, and then training training with the promoter, which, you know, doesn't work out well for you. And now, you know, whether you like it or not, you know, the Lollies have a real good level. You know, the and Santino DeFranco, you can see where he is now. Drew Fickett, you're around real people. How'd you fit in? How'd that work out?
Well, I knew I was always dedicated, you know. Because I'd tell my homies, like, yeah, I want to fight in the UFC. And they would, like, that's when Napoleon Dynamite came out. Mm-hmm. They were like, I'm going to be a cage fighter. They would all fucking rip me apart, which is what I would do too. So,
yeah.
But I remember that, you know, like, and I was like, man, you can't talk all that shit and then bitch it. So here we go. And when I knew it was just going to take me getting on a team. Because when I had, like, we were kind of building a good team. I had Yahtzee Mason was over there training, but they're all smaller, you know? And then Joe, and then Gilbert. And when I left, you know, Gilbert was kind of wanting to go over there, and, like, Yahtzee ended up coming over there. So, like, we started building some guys I had from that team. And then when I met Drew, I knew that once I got into a place and got a team, that I would fit right in because I work hard, you know? And I'm about that. I'm about it's a give and take. That's how it is. You know, some days
probably the only way you're going to stay on Drew Fickett's team is through hard work. And if you don't, he's probably going to run you out of the gym.
Oh, he made fun of me all the time. My first fight at 170, I said, I'm fighting out in a tournament. I was supposed to fight Tim Kennedy.
Okay, from ACS.
Yeah. Yep. and not no not, that's McKenzie you're thinking of maybe.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, you're right. Yep. Oh, Tim Kelly's the Marine guy. Yep, Tim Kelly's the Marine guy. Yep, you're right.
He fought in IFL, and I was like, I'm gonna fight at 170 because that I've always wanted to do a Grand Prix, and they had like where you fight multiple times in one day, old school Don Fry styles, all stoked. And then when I got up there, they were like, yeah, well, we're only letting you do one fight. The box commission stepped in. I was like, motherfucker. But before that, Drew was like, hey, you're fighting at 170. You're never going to make it. And I remember being so fucking mad at him. I'm like, what? And he's like, you're not going to make weight. And I was like, you're fucking crazy. I was so pissed. But that was like the first time he ever really even talked to me. Like, we would drill and shit. But it was just like real, real subtle. And after that, like, we're about the same size, and I was always training. So we just started training and working hard. And then.
Well, let's talk about that room. It's real interesting that, you know, you guys, like, in that room, you guys have Dominic Cruz in there. And Dominic never gets acknowledged. Like, his roots in Arizona are never acknowledged, like, ever. You know, it's always what takes place in California, but his foundation happened in Drew Fickett's gym. Am I correct when I say that?
Well, yeah. So it wasn't at Southwest, but Drew had this Team Scrub. That was his thing. He's like Team Scrub. So like, it did. In a weird way, it was. It's like where it doesn't matter where we train, you know. It didn't. Like, we got kicked out of gym. We got kicked out of this place. It didn't matter. We're like, we're gonna go train and get ready. We're gonna win with whatever we got. That's like Drew's Team Scrub. That's kind of what it meant to me. And so Travis DeGrau, Leo's, Lozon, Efren Escondero, because he used to wrestle at Pima, Dom. And there was a bunch of fighters that fought that wrestled at Pima, like Jamie Varner, Jesse Forbes, Dominic, Efren, and all those wrestlers want to fight. So when they all got out, they all kind of like started training together. And Dom used to train with Drew and all them. I had met Dom separate from Drew, but they were all connected in a weird way. I met Dom. We were both fighting at jobbing.com, and we were both scared and fighting some grown ass men. So we just started like talking to each other. That's how I met Dom. I had no idea that they were friends until I really got to know Dom. But they're all connected. Like Drew, there's so many good guys that Drew had a huge part in. Getting them ready.
Well, what was it like having Dominic Cruz in that room, you know, at such an early stage in his career?
Well, you know what? Even then, bro, he always saw things that he was looking at life like you're looking through a telescope and taking your eye out and looking down here. Because sometimes you'll be looking way down there and you'll just trip. You'll never get there. Dom always saw everything. And he was always like, he brought like a level of discipline that was the first thing I noticed from him was he was like so disciplined. And Drew was very disciplined when it came to training, but a wild boy, you know what I'm saying? Like, so him and Drew were so different, but in the room, they're all the same. And like, that was the first thing I noticed was like, Dom had all these little gimmicks. Like, I jump rope for 15 minutes. I don't drink 8 weeks before fight. He had all these like little rules, you know? And Drew had no rules, but one. But they both respected each other because when they got in the gym, like, it was all about training. Like, everyone was just there to get better. And we went to a fight. Like, if one's getting thrown out, we're all getting thrown out. Like, hey. It's my daughter and some dude. They're always flirting with each other.
Uh-oh.
Hey,
go snap his neck.
Yeah, we need the hits. Here, just bring your phone with you when you handle this.
Like they were all it was a really good room, and everybody had a goal. Like, and that's what MMA did for me. It's like it gave me light at the end of the tunnel, because before that, there was really nothing, you know. I just remember like fumbling through life and going to this party and that party and just always feeling like, man, fuck this, fuck this, fuck this, fuck this, fuck this guy, fuck that. And when I got MMA, I mean, it didn't matter that I worked at a wastewater treatment plant. It didn't matter. Like, none of that mattered. I did not care as long as I could train at the end of the day. And that was
good.
That was all that mattered. And Drew, it didn't matter who you were, where you, like, what you look like. All that mattered was you're going to show up and train, you're going to fight.
Does it surprise you to see Dominic where he's at right now? I mean, he's a brilliant combat. He has a brilliant combat sports mind.
No. When we went up, me and Dom, he came up. Don Fry was fighting in Globe. And Uriah Faber was on the card. Casey Uscola was on the card. We were just watching. And we were going up there, and I was like, I was looking at the guys my weight, because that's what guys do. So there's a guy even close to my size. I'm like, yeah, I'll beat his ass. Like, you know, like, you could not even know him, you know? And we watched some of the guys fight in the car, and he's like, you think you can beat those guys at your weight? And I was like, yeah. And I was like, Uriah Faber fought. And I said, you think you could beat him? And he said, it'd be tough, but, you know, I'm a little bit smaller or whatever. And I was like, I think you could beat him. Even all the way back then, like, it was always just like his commitment. He was always so dedicated, you know, like, he wasn't going out. When we went out, we party and stuff, but he was always like thinking about tomorrow, like thinking about the next day. Like, you can't be drinking all weekend and going dehydrated and spar Ryan Bader on Monday, Seth. It's not going to work out for you. Like, he used to say things like that to me, like, you know, like, your brain's not going to have any hydration. And then you got that big old guy hitting you. That's not good for you. Like, you'd always think about things that you would think is just common sense, but he always just broke everything down. And that's how he breaks everything down in his life. It's all through, you know, analysis and logic. Just
so when you look at Dominic Cruz's background, they say he grew up in a trailer in a trailer park in Arizona. Did you guys kind of have that bond because you guys kind of came from the same, you know, you guys from the same place in life?
He was from a different town. I didn't know him. I just met him and he was cool. You know, like, he was just cool. He's just like, I liked him. And then I heard him talk shit to Roland Sahara. And I was like, I really like this guy. Yeah, he fought in like Four Corners. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's all dust. And the guy I was fighting came in and saw me weigh in and was like, I'm not fighting that guy. So he bounced. And then I had, and I was single back then. So I had a bunch of girls with me, and Dom fought, and Dom's like, hey, what you doing, dog? And I'm like, nothing. And he's like, where are you going? I was like, we're going to go party or whatever. He's like, who's with you? I said, you know, I'm with these people. And he's like, where are you guys going? I was like, you want to come? And like, we just always kicked it. You know, like, it was always cool. Like, I could tell right off the bat, like, he was like, he would tell you exactly what he thought. And that's what I liked about him. Like, he was just very honest, even if it hurt your feelings, kind of. And maybe it's because I'm a glutton for punishment. Maybe that's why I liked him so much. But he was just very honest. And you could tell he was thinking about tomorrow. Like, he was trying to make something happen out of it.
So I'm trying to imagine things. I imagine Roland Saria probably gave him a $35 check, and he gave him a piece of his mind.
he said something about his blonde hair, dog. He had, like, he, you know, back then dudes used to dye their tips and shit.
Yeah.
And Dom just got on beating some dude's ass, just moving on. Just dude didn't even touch him. Just whoop, 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 just body shotting the shit out of him. And I remember thinking, like, man, I ain't never seen nobody move like that.
His movement is insane, and it's his own movement.
He reminded me. I watched boxing, but I never had a boxing coach. He reminded me of Willie Pep, like an MMA Willie Pep. That was the first thought I had when I saw him.
One of the greatest defensive fighters ever to live.
Just the way he moved, like, he had this really herky jerky, but it was like his own. No one has a rhythm like that. And Roland said something about his dyed hair, because that was Roland's thing. Like, he was always jealous of everyone that had the balls to fight. So he would, like, belittle guys on his shows, like, get on the microphone, you know, like, oh, you need a tan or something, like, kind of shit on him. And he said something about Dom's hair, and Dom just got crazy on him. And I'm like, oh, I really like this guy. He's a little firecracker, you know? It's my kind of guy. So
you got two wins in a row. You roll into Seth Ballantyne December 2nd, 2006, where you hit an armbar.
I talked so much shit before that fight about Tim Sylvia. So I don't know Tim Sylvia, but he got tapped out in an ankle lock. And I'm like, man, does that even break bones? And someone's like, nah, it just hurts. And I'm like, I'll never tap that out. Quick fighting. And that dude got me in a gnarliest ankle lock. And I'm like, well, you really fucked yourself here, Seth. Like, he fucked my leg up, dude. He fucked my ankle up. Started popping, and it scared him, so he let go. But he looked at the ref, and I was like, I'm good. And I got up, and I stomped my foot. It was fucked up, but – and then I armbarred him. But my foot was – I learned jiu-jitsu was not a game that day. I was like, all right, you really need to learn how to start defending this shit. Because it was – I mean, those were the dudes that won back in the day. Is if you had a skill set. It's not if you had all skill sets. Mm-hmm. Now guys have all skill sets. Like, they can stand up, they can wrestle, they can do jiu-jitsu. There's a blueprint. But back then, like, if a guy had a jiu-jitsu and the other guy didn't, and went to the ground, it was over. You know, like guys were so – it was so premature and so different. He was Seth Ballantyne. I think he was an army dude, but he had some karate. He threw a spinning back kick at me, and I had no idea what the fuck that was. When he threw that, I'm like, whoa, you don't want to get caught with that, dog. Like, what's that, you know? It was crazy.
So you take 4 months off, which is a long time for you because you're kind of rattling these things off once a month, and you get the call to the IFL. I think you were on Don Fry's team. Am I correct? The Scorpions?
Don Fry, the legend himself. Yes. Okay. So Rich Moss knew Don Fry's judo coach, and they needed an 85er. It might have been Shane Battlecat. I can't remember if it was Shane Battlecat or Dwayne Johnson, one or the other. Compton. Maybe I'm saying it wrong. I'm sorry if I did, Mr. Compton. I know his last name was Compton. And I had to go down and spar Don Fry. I straight up, they're like, hey, you got to go spar Don Fry and Mike Whitehead to see if you're good enough to make it. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to fuck these dudes up because I trained with heavyweights. Like, I trained with Gilbert and Joe for so long. Like, I knew how to navigate around heavyweights pretty easy. And I had to just fucking move, you know? And I was like, all right, well, like, we got to do it. Let's go. And so they're like, next Friday, we're going down there. You're going to spar. I said, all right, cool. And I walk in, and Don Fry has purple spandex on. And, dog, they're like the girl spandex, the ones that you pull the thing under the ankle. You know, it's got, like, the little elastic thing on the bottom. You remember from the 80s, the girls used to put those on, then they used to put up the big old socks in the Reeboks. Mm-hmm. But he had some purple spandex on. I don't know if he had underwear, but I could see everything he had on underneath it, you know, stuck to his skin. And he was jacked, dog. Shirt off the whole time, just winking at everybody in the place. And we're going to spar. So we get in there and we're moving around. He has big ass headgear. And I remember thinking, like, all right, man, like, you don't want to get hit with this dude. So I'm like, just using the speed. And I could tell there was a distinct speed advantage, like, right away. And I started landing some big shots. And he goes, after that round, like, because he's a G, he's not going to stop in the middle of the round. He waited till the round was over, and he was like, what size bloods you got on? And I said, 16s. He's like, get my 16s. This boy's cheating, I told him. I said, huh? I'm just, like, so... take it back.
Stop,
like,
Fry.
Yeah, I couldn't believe he said I was cheating because I used 16. I'm like, those are standard glove size. And he's like, whatever, I'm going to get my 16s. I was like, all right, dog. So then he got him on, and I started really landing some shots. We started getting in. Then in, like, the third, fourth round, he started getting tired. We're only supposed to go, like, two. And I remember thinking, like, he's not going to stop until he wins a round. And I go to the corner and I'm like, yeah, hey, I think I need to slow, like, the pace down a little bit or something. And it was clear in my mind he wasn't stopping unless. So, like, he ends up getting me, like, that over under. that, you know, where he kind of grabs a head, but he was like, he had an underhook.
It's like a plumb. It's like a half tie plumb.
He's beating on my ribs, beating on my head. And once he felt like he got around, he's like, yeah, we're good. And then I had a spar too with Mike Whitehead. And Mike Whitehead was coming in hot. I don't think he liked Tucson very much. And I was moving because he's like 260, man.
He's huge. And you're Shark Tanked at this time, at this point.
I was so young, bro. I didn't even think about getting tired, bro. I tell kids all the time, how old are you? They're like 20. I'm like, you're not allowed to be tired till you're 30. Shut up. Like, let's go. And I was like, I could go, you know? So we were going, I was moving. And I remember I was landing some shots on him, but I was being cautious because one shot could be a bad deal for me. And I remember he yelled at me. He goes, why don't you box me? And I go, I am stupid. Like, you're 260 pounds. What do you want me to stand there and slug? Like, you know, like, what are you talking about? And then he freaking like grabbed me and hip tossed me over the ring. Just grabbed me, hip toss over the ring, dog. I went over the rope, landed on my back, and Don Fry came in there, bro. Straight up. Grabbed him up, started. I think he kicked him out of Tucson and kicked him out of the U.S., dog. Don Fry was just like, yeah, he's going crazy. You act like that, and Mike, get out of this gym. Get out of Tucson. Get out of Arizona. Like, he kicked him out of the whole.
You went pro wrestling on him.
Yeah, bro. And I was like, at that moment, I was like, Don Fry is awesome. You know, because he could have fucked me up. Like,
oh, he tried to hurt you.
Yeah. He was pissed. And then,
well, where he came from, the Miletich fighting system, that was kind of commonplace there.
I didn't know that. I didn't know nobody, you know. I don't hold it against him. I get it. Hey, in sports, people get frustrated, right? But I definitely wasn't a fan of his.
No. And you know, so you pass the test. You make it to the IFL. So now you're actually seeing a decent check for a fight, but the level of competition is night and day to what you're used to.
I was so blown away that I was going to be able to just fight out of state. You know, it was in Connecticut, in Mohegan Sun. Everything's new to me, right? Like the whole thing. I travel by myself. They all travel from Tucson. So I go to the airport in Phoenix. They're on different flights. I'm at the airport in Connecticut for a long time waiting for them. They get in and Don Fry's hammered drunk. And in Connecticut, they stopped selling beer pretty early. I think like 10 or whatever. And he's just like, God damn, where can you get a goddamn beer around here? And he's just freaking out, wanting some whole beers. You know, which I get. Because when I drank, I was like him. And he just had us going to all these different places looking for beers. They kept telling the same thing. Like, hey, homie, we stopped selling at 10 or whatever. So it was like, I could tell like it was going to be a real fun weekend already. Like, just cause Don was making me laugh. Some guys were annoyed, but I thought it was hilarious, you know? And then.
Oh, you're used to Drew Fickett too.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what your niche is. Like, nobody's perfect, right? Everyone's got something about them. And it's like, I can handle that because I've had so many of my people in my life like that. I can handle those guys all day. Which I definitely got to touch base on that later with my Jesse Taylor and Ordul's story. But, you know, there were so many guys. There was like all the pit bulls were there.
So the pit bulls were Henzo's team. Yeah. Carlos Newton had the Dragons. You guys were the Scorpions. I think there was one other team. I'm not sure what it.
The Wolverines.
Was the Wolverines or the Anacondas?
The Wolves, like the Oregon Wolves or whatever. Because Chael Sonnen was there. I remember the first time I saw Chael Sonnen. I didn't know him. I didn't know shit. But he looked like a funny dude. Like, he was just always laughing and shit, you know? And I was like, man, like, what's it? This dude kind of looks like this dude kind of is a different looking individual, you know? Like, he don't look like he'd be fighting. He's real. And back then, he was real young. and they had a member at Matt Horwich.
Oh, dude, he was a wild man.
Well, he was really smart, though. He's a little socially awkward, but he was real smart. You could tell. And
we were he's all good. Like, he's fuck. Good if you could get him to shower once a month.
That's a serious issue in a jiu-jitsu gym. Is you gotta wash your body as a service to the community. yeah, and you're 100%. But I liked him. He was a little socially awkward, but I liked him. And Dom was again hammer drunk the next day, and he had a outfit on that would make Donald Cerrone. No matter what Donald Cerrone was wearing, it would just put him down. He had a sick ass like cowboy shirt on, and
did he have the string tie, like the shoestring?
Nah, it was like three buttons down by then because he was three sheets past it, you know. But he had all these turquoise and crazy ass jewelry on, and he was ready to go. And we're all sitting in the lobby, and he was drinking some cold beers. I mean, Boss Rutan's there. You got all these crazy famous people there. And I don't know how, I didn't know how it happened at the time, but Matt Horwich comes up to Don Fry with like a list of groceries. And he's like, real socially weird, you know? He's like, hey, Don, you're going to the store, he has money and a list. And he's like, can you give me some bread and some meat? I want a sandwich. And Don Fry looks at him and goes, you think this is a fucking game? I'm like, what's happening here? Dude, Don jumps up and like starts taking his jewelry off. Like I thought he was gonna straight scrap. And Chael comes over laughing and Dennis Holman. And then they try to break it up and Don pushes one of them. And then him and Holman almost get into it. Like this big old fight almost erupts. I guess Chael saw him. Horwich was like, I need to go get a sandwich. He's like, go ask Don. He's going. He was just like, fuck it with Don. So he was like gooning him all the way back then. You know, like it was such a crazy, all these people just getting ready to scrap like 8 p.m. And it was wild back then. Like dudes are real crazy. It's way tame now because social media and cameras, you can't be fist fighting in the lobby like back in the day.
No,
Don Fry was ready to go though.
What was the process like? You Don had to be in your corner, obviously. Were you comfortable with that at that time? Did it matter to you?
You know, I remember I fought Brett Beauparlant. It was a good fight. Like it was a really good fight. And I got a cut. Like I think in the second round, he was like in a scramble. He elbowed me, and all I remember Don really saying was like, you're fine. You're fine. You're good. This guy's gas. Like he never really gave me anything else, but in a weird way, it calmed me down because knowing like he's fought and shit, like knowing that he's been there and dude, I don't give a care. Like having Don in front of you with a cowboy hat in your corner, I'm cool with that every day. he's one of my favorite fighters of all time. And he had no filter. He just said exactly what was on his mind, no matter who was there. And I always, you always respect that because you know what you're going to get, you know?
Well, there's no show there. It's, this is who I am. I'm not, you know, I'm not afraid to show who I am. Like it's a lot of people, they're scared to show their real selves where Don can walk out the front door and man, this is it, man. It's, you know, love me or hate me, it's cool, but I'm not going to change.
Yeah, he was just straight up, like, and he was, like, down the scrap, too. Like, he was just, like, if you showed up and fought, like, that's all that mattered, you know? Like, it wasn't anything else. There was no, like, fucking politics in it. There's no bullshit. Like, he was cool.
How was it dealing with the owners?
A lot of fun. Huh?
How was it dealing with the owners of the IFL?
I never dealt with them. I fought for them twice, and then it kind of, like, dissolved. I heard after I fought for him a few times that I guess guys were getting like money every month. I never got no money every month.
See, I was going to ask you that because where you come from with the, you know, Arizona scene, you know, you may not even have seen like you know, a contract or anything like that. Now the IFL, you had to sign something and stuff. Is that scary? You don't have a lawyer. It's like, what were your thoughts with that? Or you're like, I'm in, I don't care. Like a lot of the early guys in the early part of their career, URC early guys, sign me up, you know, it doesn't matter. But were you thinking about that?
There was some drawbacks where I was like, but then I'm looking at it. If you pull it out and look at it and give a 50,000 mile view, it's like, all right, well, you can keep fucking with Roland Sahara and make $35 a fight. You're not getting any younger. And it was just opportunity to compete, you know, and I hope the game's changed quite a bit because, you know, back when we used to fight on a local scene, like guys would get paid quite a bit more. And when I got cut from the UFC and was trying to get fights, like, I was so blown away how much the market had changed. And it's from guys taking fights for whatever they can, you know? So that was definitely a thought though. And it was definitely like, all right, well, like every time you're in these fights, like you're going to be getting hit in the head, it's taking years off your body, it's taking years off your life. Like, you know, but it was definitely more money than I was making at the sanitation plant too, you know? So,
it's just life changer. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just an opportunity and an opportunity. I had kids, I already had, you know, a son, and it was just more about putting money in the bank and have an opportunity to go compete. And like, cause I wanted to fight in the UFC cause that was the only thing that was around then. But, I definitely wanted to travel and fight and the game changed so much, like guys travel and there's so much knowledge that's spread because guys go to different gyms. It's like so much different now. It's so much cooler than it was when I was a kid.
Your next fight in the IFL was against an opponent that started at heavyweight and worked his way down to 85 named Dan Molina.
Oh, yeah. That was the only way I was going to lose that fight, too.
That guy was huge.
Yeah, it was the only way. I remember someone saying, yeah, it's the only way you're going to lose that fight is if he heel hooked you. And he heel hooked me. You know, I thought I drilled it enough and obviously didn't. And he did a good job of securing it. And I, you know, back then there were so many times, if I go back and watch some of my old fights, I just lose no composure, you know, like it really
there's some maturity.
It really hurts me to see those fights. Like if I look at them now, it's like looking in the sun. It like hurts my eyes. You know,
but your record, I mean, your videos on YouTube are pretty much scrubbed. Like very little independent indie grind video footage of you exists.
It was Joe Biden, man. He knows I support Donald Trump. He scrubbed them all. I'm joking.
Well, it was probably Roland Saria
that guy's video library is amazing and he's got nothing online.
Yeah, he probably tried to still sell DVDs, I bet.
Oh my god, I wouldn't doubt that, man. I wouldn't doubt that. So you go from Molina to Miguel, a Bodog co-promoted show, Tough Enough. You fight Chris Kennedy. So you're on a two-fight skid, and online your record appears to be 4-5. It's a little beat up, but I think those amateur fights got added afterward, as you had stated. But, you know, it's a little beat up. It's like actually like 4-3 if you subtract some of those.
There was definitely a couple long conversations with myself on the way home from the gym where I was like, you need to figure something out. Around that time, you know, I was already training with Drew and them. But it was clear to me that I was getting better and I was bigger than a lot of the guys at my gym. So, you know, Gilbert had passed away and Joe would train, but I couldn't spar with him like that anymore because he was getting older too, you know, couldn't be just like taking all kinds of shots and shit all the time. And I was like, it was clear to me that I needed to start getting guys that were like more my size. And I think right around
on your fights. Yeah.
Right around there. I think maybe a year later we got everyone got sponsored for MTX. Guys used to get sponsorship, like monthly sponsorships and shit. And I remember being so happy because, like, I had money to hire, like, a good coach, like a striking coach. And then I found – I was just looking for a long time, finding somebody, like – it was important to me to get somebody that had MMA knowledge and then could deal with a long-rangey fighter. And I found this card of Rob Monroe. He's a cut man for the UFC now. But it was him holding a pads with Carlos Condit on it. And I was like, hey, Condit fights cool. I like to fight like that. And I remember being happy because I had that money I could invest into a coach. So I started working with him. And then I was just kind of looking around for guys to start wrestling with that were more my size and could help me deal with, because it was clear to me, like, dealing with guys, it was going to be like I had a decent back game. I was good off my back. I was okay enough. So guys were just like going to take me down. That's how everyone's going to beat me. They're going to point fight me. At that point in my career, I felt like guys were just going to point fight me. So it was very clear to me I had to make a change. And I started doing what I could, just finding what I could. And eventually I ended up working with Robin Rowe and a bunch of those, Brian Bader and all them. That's kind of where I ended up going in the longabout route anyway.
So your fight against Chris Kennedy, you get a knockout in the first round. It's a really good bounce back fight. I think, where was that fight at? Was it in Vegas, I'm assuming?
Yep. I was in Vegas. That was when I was supposed to be a tournament. It was like Tough Enough, but it was like a Bodog promotion.
Yeah. Miguel, like, did you have any play in that, or were you still there at that point?
Tough Enough is a guy named Meyer. Is this like Gary Meyer, I believe is his name?
It was Barry Meyer.
Barry Meyer passed away. Yeah. And yeah. But he was a Vegas person. Like, his father had inns at the casinos that they used and stuff. Like, they were wealthy. And because it's an amateur show, they were always able to operate even with the UFC in town. They managed the politics. That was Barry Meyer's show. And Barry was very good friends with Jeff. So that's after my run.
It's about Jeff Osborne.
Yeah. And so that's after my run at Bodog, because that's probably not a connection I would have used. Tough Enough was still kind of an amateur show or a smaller entity there. So, but anyway, Seth, did I meet you? You came to Russia one time, didn't you?
Yeah, I did meet you.
You were cornering.
I was cornering Robert
McClintock.
No, I was friends with McClintock.
Oh, it's Jacob McClintock.
Yep, Jacob. Yeah, remember he got his eye swole up real bad.
That was a great fight. The reason I asked though is that you were with the Lollies at that point, and I know that, you know, Joe called him Pecs, and Drew got thrown out of the school there and stuff. But they go back a long way, all the way to like Matt Hume and stuff. And talk about that relationship and how they work into the mix with you.
You know, they were cool. Like, I never had a personal issue with them, you know, like, it was just clear to me, like, they had all kinds of big fights over there. And if I came in there, I knew I was just going to be like a sparring dummy for everybody. So I wanted to go somewhere where I could get some technical one-on-ones and kind of learn how to navigate through some of these situations. And later on, I had met them because they all knew Santino, and they were always cool to me. Like, I never had a real problem with them. If you talk MMA with them, those guys always got along good with them. It's just, I always thought it was funny that Joe Riggs called them Pecs. That was just all I always think of that. But those guys were always cool. And, you know, I remember going over there, they had like Steve Steinbest, who I'm really good friends with, Ray Steinbest, Jesse Forbes, Aaron Simpson, CB
Still
Dolan,
Hawkins there?
Huh?
Was Del Hawkins there as well?
Yeah, I think he was for a little bit. There was just so many good. Many good fighters, you know, and I was just kind of doing my own thing. Like, I would train my jiu-jitsu at Santino's. I'd go to Robin Rose, and then I'd go there for sparring. And I ended up having to go there all the time because they were the only guys that, you know, I was the worst student in the room. They used to beat the shit out of me all the time, so I felt like I was getting better.
Are you comfortable talking with, why was Drew asked to leave there?
I don't know. And that's one thing I've always stayed away from.
That's smart.
Just because everyone in my opinion, will like inject themselves into a situation, but they're not in it, you know? So there's always so many different factors. And so it could be the interpretation of what Drew did or the interpretation of what the Lollies did. All I ever did was put it on face value. They're always cool to me and I'm always cool to them. And
mind your own business.
Yeah. That's I just wanted to get better. And when I went in there, I talked about fighting with them and that was it, you know, and I still have a good relationship with all of them.
That's good. So just to kind of tie a knot on that, Barry Meyer, what won you won by knockout in the first round against Chris Kennedy, which, you know, you got an airplane ride, you know, you're in Vegas and, you know, you do well, you do what you're supposed to do. Barry Meyer, I really liked him a lot. He and I used to talk on the phone all the time, just about like regional fights that could take place. Unfortunately, you know, depression and, you know, other mitigating factors kind of came in and, you know, and he departed early. But what a phenomenal human being that guy was.
You know, it was definitely one of the shows where I was bummed that they didn't have more of them. You know, it was fun. They had a good setup. And anytime you fight in Vegas, it's good, man. Like, you know, I remember my first fight in Vegas, walking out and seeing like Jeremy Horn and all these dudes in the front row getting ready to watch me. And I'm like, I didn't think of that. Like, you know, like,
that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, it was just, it's just a cool place, man. It's the fight station of the world.
Yeah. All right. So from here, all right, you go and do something that I hope Drew Fickett was your corner for this. Full Moon fighting in Mexico. You fight Keto, a future Ultimate Fighter veteran, Keto Andrews.
Yeah. Yep.
First off, Keto's from Team Alpha Male. Super tough fight. You know, he normally fights at 205. And, you know, that's a lot to chew on.
I think that's when I fought three times in 1 month. I fought Kennedy. And then I had like, I either fought Kennedy and Andrews. And then I had a week off and I fought Jordan Pegula.
Yeah, that was like about a month and a half. You fought three times. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. It was, and I remember, yeah, he was tough. And, you know, of all people, I'm down there and Santino had a wedding. And then Joe had something else going on too. And we had our whole team down there and we had no coaches. So I had to corner everybody. And then fight in the main event.
Who was the promoter?
Chad, Josh Griggs.
Man, there's a couple promoters in Mexico. It didn't end well for them.
No, he used to fight in the IFL. He was a heavyweight. And they were cool. Like, it was a cool little show, especially from Southern Arizona. It's a 5.5-hour trip. We all get to go down there. They'd always get multiple guys on the card. And those are some of the funnest fights in my career are the ones where, you know, back in the day when you're all just cruising down there with your team and Drew was there. Drew was, I don't think he made it very much through the whole event, but he was down there. I think he might've got booted early or something happened to him. And I had
I'm to sure it wasn't everybody. Due to his own fault. I'm sure it was that.
I had to corner everybody and then fight in it. And of all people, I remember being so fucking pissed that Mike White said, "You don't got a corner." I was like, "Huh?" And he's like, "I'll be in your corner." I was like, "Damn!" I remember I was so mad he was in my corner. But Keto Andrews was a tough fight.
Andrews is legit guy, and you win in the third round by triangle. How did the first two rounds go?
I could honestly, dude, be honest, I could have choked him out in the first minute with a triangle, but I had this weird little thing in my mind. Because I come from the other side of tracks. Like, Tim Kennedy was a cop. Keto Andrews was a prison guard. And Jordan Pergola was a firefighter.
You talk about Chris Kennedy.
Yeah, Chris Kennedy. I'm sorry. Chris Kennedy.
He was a cop.
Yep. Keto Andrews was a prison guard. And then I had a week or something off. I was fighting Jordan Pergola in Florida, and he was a firefighter. So I was like, in my own little weird mind, I was like, I'm gonna fuck all these government employees up, because I was on probation my whole life. Like, I'm gonna fuck this dude up. I'm gonna fuck this dude up. It was just his own little war I made in my mind.
That you're doing nation business on the first responders.
Yeah, I was gonna clean the house for him. I was gonna show him what's up. You know, I was gonna let my brother. I was gonna let my brother and all his homies on the yard. All my boys have been locked up. I'm gonna let them all know I fucked this cop up, I fucked the prison guard up, and I fucked the firefighter up for all you guys. You know, maybe I'll throw a riot or something, whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. But that was this weird little thing I made in my mind. I could have choked him out. And I remember I was like, man, I want a TKO. I wanted to get a TKO. And I swept him, and he had a good chin, bro. I hit him so many times, and the ref didn't miss the call. Like, he just had a real good chin. And I ended up catching him in a triangle in the third round. You know, I didn't want to not get a finish, but it sounds arrogant.
I tell you what, when I saw that finish, when I saw that finish on your record, I was shocked. I'm like, I just figured it's definitely a step up. Like those IFL fights that you struggled with, you know, a few fights prior, this was of that caliber, and you found a finish. Like that's. Like you're leveling up. You can see yourself maturing and getting better.
Yeah, we had good training partners. You know, I drilled a lot. You know, it was every MMA guy that's good. There's a team behind him. You know, Drew and all those guys from Team Scrub. Like he brought a bunch of wrestlers in. I was going and sparring with good guys, and that was really it was just me finding a way and whatever I had to do. I mean, there was times I would get off. Work and go work out and then sleep in the parking lot to work out with Rob, you know, before I went home, just lay there in my car and rest for an hour and a half before. I started figuring a little formula out there. You know, I started getting a little momentum. I started getting a little confident. And then I started like really hitting my stride right around then.
Well, let's talk about those Mexico shows existed so that you wouldn't have to deal with commissions.
Oh yeah.
So it was highly unregulated. Usually there's a lot, like some narco traffic activity. Sometimes there's some birds fighting in certain areas of those events. Did you witness any of that?
Bro, well, my last fight in Mexico was, I mean, this is way down the road, but yeah, bro, like it's Mexico. Like We would get shooken down every time we were there. The cops would pull us over. They'd go through the whole thing, like the whole negotiation of how much we're going to pay for them to go away. You know, it's Mexico. That's what it is. Those were the funnest trips. Like, those were the funnest trips because it was just about all of us training. We all had a reason to train. We all had something to get ready for. And we had so much fun on those fights. Like, even – guys that won, guys that lost, like it was always a blast. You know, we always had such a good time.
Is it true that Mexico is more fun with a drunk Drew Fickett?
Listen, Drew Fickett, he was cornering this cat one time and he was hammered drunk. I mean, I'm talking tuxedo front row, tuxedo t-shirt front row.
So he wore his finest t-shirt. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. What time is it?
You're not leaving us in the middle of a Drew Fickett story.
No.
just kidding.
He was, there was this guy, Carlos, that was fighting and he wasn't very good, but he was fighting this dude that was like a legitimate jiu-jitsu guy. And Carlos dropped him. And all of us were surprised. Like everyone in the corner, whoa! And Drew ran up to the cage and the guy's head was in the cage. And one second, this guy keeps texting me and he's bothering me. And this guy, you there? This guy's head was in the cage, like up on the cage. And Carlos was hitting him, trying to get the finish. And Drew runs to like the other side of the fence. And he's got his fingers like on the fence, he's screaming in the dude's ear, die, 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 die. Like he's going real crazy. He was going crazy, bro. And then I remember just stepping back and looking at him, and he had no shoes on, socks, and they were dirty as fuck. He was just fucking ripping it, dude. And man, my boy Yassim comes up and is like, fuck, what are we gonna do with Drew tonight after these fights? I'm like, I don't know, bro. Try to find a bed for him and lay him down, I guess. I don't know what we're gonna do with him. But he was just wild, bro. He used to say the craziest shit, like Travis DeGrout, years after we fought, he had to fight some dude and Aaron Simpson being the last minute replacement. And Travis like, yeah, they want me to fight Aaron Simpson. I said, yes. And he looks at him and goes, you're fighting Aaron Simpson now? And he goes, yeah. He goes, Aaron Simpson's an All-American wrestler. You're an All-American wrestler. Aaron Simpson's a better All-American wrestler. He was like very crazy. I was just grabbing his arm like, come on, Drew. Like, he just always said the craziest shit, dude. Fucking love being with Drew. He's my guy, man. You know, like, the thing about Drew is he could be completely inebriated and a 10 times better coach than most of the coaches on the planet. And as good of a fighter as he is, like his ability to get everyone to buy into his law of enrollment, which is pretty much getting everyone to see your vision. Like, he made it so much fun that you never wanted to miss practice. You know, you never wanted to miss practice. He made everything so much fun. And if you think about some of the guys he's been a part of, Jamie Varner, Efren Escondero, Jesse Forbes, me, Dominic Cruz. I mean, there's so many fighters. I can't even remember them all right now that he really just kind of his philosophy of, because so many fighters waste all their best years in the gym. You know, I mean, how many fighters you seen that were scared to fight? That they always want a corpse. They want you to drag someone out there who's not going to fight back, you know. And Drew wasn't about like your record or none of that shit. It was like, well, you go compete and then you find out where you're really at, because it's the only true gauge is really competition. Like, all your partners can know how you move and they know the things you're good at, and human nature to avoid shooting on Ryan Bader. Yeah, I don't want to shoot on Ryan Bader. That shit hurts. So even though I know I probably should shoot, my body not going to want to let me do that. So like, the only true gauge is competition. And that's what it was always about, was like, why all these guys spend this whole life in a gym and never compete, you know? And that's what I thought Drew always brought to the table, is he was just like, who gives a fuck? Let's fight next weekend. Oh, you lost? Okay, cool. Let's fight next weekend. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just like, whatever, like, you know? He was just fucking.
Mike, you're on mute.
So Drew Fickett, he told us a crazy story about what is it, a pizza place, Miguel? The Papa John's.
And we got kicked off the Ultimate Fighter.
Were you in his life at that time?
No. But I remember, yeah, he didn't talk about it much back then, because I think it still kind of hurt him back then that he wasn't on the Ultimate Fighter. But I kind of like started getting to know him, and he's one of the guys, like, it takes a long time to get to know Drew, you know? And I remember hearing the story about him, and I've been trying to find the video for years, where, cause he told me he originally wanted to be Drew the Nightmare Fickett. So Diego Sanchez, right? And I always thought that would have been a good fight, even back then, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Drew said he was interviewed, like he was at a show or something, and someone had a VHS like recorder, and Drew interviewed him as a reporter, though. like not as Drew Fickett. So he was
playing a role.
Fickett and shit. So, He pulled the biggest goon move on Diego Sanchez ever. I've been trying to find that interview desperately. Cool. So he would always do crazy shit like that. And, you know, he was always ready to go. And he had some real exciting fights too, man. Like, he would pull off some wins where you're like, how did he even make it out of that, you know, without
getting his head kicked off.
And it was, he never quit. It would be like 3 seconds left in the fight. And he would, you can't say it's luck when somebody consistently does something. That's true.
That's what MMA is so fucking awesome about, is like, you may not be able to beat this guy you look on the paper and you're like, this guy's going to smoke that guy. But there's so many little transitions and positions where guys can get finishes and guys can get chokes. And Drew is like the epitome of that. It's like finding a way. Like, he would find a way, you know? And sometimes you don't know how you're going to beat him. And Drew, you know, sometimes you got to get in there and you got to go through three rounds of shit to get it. And he did that against Koscheck. He always pulled these crazy fights off. And I always thought,
Carlo Prater too.
Dude, I was on Ultimate Fighter with Tito Ortiz, Chuck Liddell, Saul Solis. You guys remember him?
Of course. Boxing coach.
Recently died. But he was cool.
He was cool as fuck. I liked him. And he's like, do you train with Drew Fickett? And I was like, yeah, I train with Drew. And he goes, man, that guy's one of the toughest guys I ever had fight for me. He said, I had a Grand Prix, which I've always wanted to fight in. And he said that he had a tough row, a murderous row of guys. And he said Drew had a huge cut and got stitched back up and went and beat Carlos Prater and had a big cut and got stitched. I was like, man, I don't know why. I always thought that was so cool to get stitched back up and go fight after it.
Some Rocky moment. Yeah.
But it's just, you know, it's just like, he always did really well in those tournaments because his endurance and it's a lot of his brains too. Like, he'll avoid stuff. He'll get guys tired. Like, you know, he'll find a way. The real strong guy.
He's a totally unique dude. The interesting thing is, a lot of, you know, sometimes the partying and stuff is what you hear first, but he's a high level dude. And then people say, well, how good would he have been if he didn't party? And I think that misses a little bit of it, because I think that uniqueness and that wackiness is part of him, man. You know, that walk his own path.
Keeps people guessing.
He might not have been. Yeah, might not have been all that, you know. I think he's a total package.
I think you're 100% right. Like, I've seen guys in my career that were phenomenal finish artists, and sometimes every person's different. Sometimes if you take away and you give them a real structured life, and you're like, well, what could this guy do if he trained like Dominic Cruz, you know, and he jumped rope for 15 minutes? But that's Dominic's way of getting ready. You know, like that's how he gets ready. He jumps rope. He does this. He does that. And he's got this system. And all he knows is every time he does his system, when he goes to fight, it's ready and it works. So he doesn't vary from it. But some guys, they're really good and they'll stop partying and do all that dedication. And then it like takes away their recklessness. Like, it takes away their freak, because they'll go out there and just whop. They'll do some crazy stuff. And it makes them like, it almost makes them so, it takes away the release almost, you know, like they mm-hmm. can't, it's too stressful. I think that's why John Jones be effing everybody up, because that dude party like a rock star and still get it in, huh? He's a savage, you know, but I've seen it happen, and to each his own, like, you know, I ain't tripping, but I've always wondered that, like, there's no way to do a real experiment on that, you know, like how, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just to the fighter, you know, and that just shows like how hard this sport, and every sport is to be good at it for a long time and deal with life. That's the hard part. Fighting's easy.
What was it like fighting for the XFC promoter? That's the Jordan Pergola fight where you won by triangle. What was it like fighting for John Prisco? What was your experience like?
I just went there and weighed in, and he was cool. Like, I didn't have any issues with him. When he found out that I fought the week before, and he was kind of salty, like, oh, you could get hurt. And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm here, you know, like, so.
Yeah, just to clean that up for you, you said, so February 1st, you fought Chris Kennedy. Then February 23rd, you went down to Mexico and fought in that Full Moon show. And then March 2nd, all within a month, three fights, you were in this as XFC. So a little
deeper. Yeah.
And XFC was a good organization.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, it was in Tampa Bay, and they had my boy Danny Martinez was on the card too. So I was, you know, he's one of my best friends. So I was real excited to get to go get to go get it in with him. And it was cool, man. I was just happy to get out. I hurt my foot real bad in that Keto Andrews. I hurt my foot real bad. So I was happy to fight. I got out of it early with the win. I wasn't worried really about any of that. I just wanted to rack off three wins and start moving to bigger shows. I wanted to get in like WC at that time.
You know what's crazy is now you come full circle after that. And on June 7th, 2008, you're back on Rage in the Cage against Eddie Crazy Face. You can't forget that nickname. Future M1 veteran, Eddie Arizmendi.
Bro, Drew, I was in the Rodeo Lounge Bar and Grill drinking an ice cold beer. And Drew called me. And Drew goes, "What are you doing?" Like, real weird, too. "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I'm drinking cold beers. What's up?" I thought he was there because he was talking so weird to me. You know, I was like looking behind me and shit. And he's like, "You want to fight this weekend at the Desert Diamond Casino?" Like, real crazy. And I go, "Yeah, who am I fighting?" He goes, "Does it matter?" And I go, "No." And he goes, "Be there at 4 or whatever." And so I had no idea who I was fighting. No idea. I drove down there.
You couldn't let Drew down, though. You couldn't let him down.
Who cares? Let's get it. And I get down there. I'm looking around the room, and I'm like, who the fuck in Tucson would fight me down here? And I'm like, looking around. And back then, the same day fight. So, like, they would get all dudes in the room, and they would call you. Like, way before it, they would say, "Hey, this guy, that guy," and you stand up. And sometimes that's the first time you've seen your opponent, you know? And they go, "Seth Pazinski." And I stood up, and I see Eddie Arizmendi stand up. And I'm like, oh, I don't know why I didn't think him, because he's a big dude. He's like 6'5".
Yeah.
Long reach.
Another heavy guy, too. You're fighting heavier opponents at lower weight class.
Yeah.
Like, he
was good. He was definitely some. And I remember the first thing I saw when I got like face to face with him is how long his arms were. Like, his arms were so long. I was like, man, he's big. He's bigger than you think. You know, some guys don't look as big as they are. And you get next to him and you're like, whoa. I remember he threw a hook early, and I backed up. And I thought I was way out. Boom. And I thought I was way out. It clipped me. And I ended up choking him out pretty quick. But I always thought it was funny, like, how Drew, that was the most bizarre phone call for a fight I've ever gotten in my life.
Well, he fought the Stoos killer, Jeff Hornlocker.
How did everyone else get that fight? I'm still mad about that. My whole team, everyone on my team got that fight. Except me.
Everyone beat him on your team.
I used to bitch about that a lot. Like, hey, what? Everyone's like, we got someone's fight. And I'm like, well, can we get the Stoos killer there? Like, I'll be there cornering you. I'll bring my medicals. Like, we used to take our medicals, mouthpiece, and cup to every fight. Straight up. And I don't know how many times I've seen dudes close to my weight be like, oh, man, I trained so hard for this, like putting a big show on when they didn't get the fight. I'd be like, hey, here's my medicals and shit. I'll fight you.
Now you need to train for that.
Yeah, well, we don't know who you are. And I'm like, yeah, cool, dog. I was just letting you know I'm here just in case you want to get it in.
We used to call guys like you the JICs, the Justin Cases. Like, these guys will fight anyone, anywhere. They're here. You know what? I would always give like a $25 just to show up. I need you here, free ticket, you and your old lady. And if I use you, I use you. You know, if not, dude, I got a couple drinks.
You train. Look, my record wasn't perfect. You know, if I had a 9-0 record, I might not have been like that. But at my record, it's more just like, all right, well, how many can I get in? You know, I can't, you know, it's like if shows are going to bring me on, it's because they like the way I fight. And that's it. It wasn't for my record. And they were going to bring me in for their guys to beat. That was clear. Like, I wasn't getting plane tickets to fight guys that I was going to smash. And it was rare.
Well, I think they always brought you in as the B side. Were you a ticket seller?
You know, I sold a lot of tickets, but I never really, like, I think the first set of tickets or something I sold, like, there was some oh, well, you'll get percentage of tickets. And then it was like, well, however many tickets you sell, will you get, they got to buy them online. And I'm like, well, just get, like, give me hard copy tickets. Cause that was the only way I would sell tickets. Cause then,
yeah,
then I would know exactly how many I sold. So it was just the promotions that we had, like I'd sell a decent amount. There was never shows consistent enough out here to really do that, you know?
Okay.
The shows that I did fight in, I'd sell some tickets though.
That's cool. You fought on war. That helps. That helps with opponents, yeah, especially on the indie grind. If you're a big ticket seller, they're looking out for you. If you're not, they're trying to get you killed.
Or if he's rolling to hair, he just doesn't care.
That's right. Warriors Collide. You fought Don Lillies, a fellow IFL veteran. He's 10-5. You're 8-7 at the time. You know, when you look at your career trajectory at this time, it's hard to pick you out of a lineup of somebody that's going to make it to the UFC, but you keep leveling up. And in this fight, I mean, obviously you lose, you know, to an anaconda choke, but at some point you find a different gear.
That was a big learning moment for me too. I remember my homie Joe Leyva, cause he would always say things like, he would always tell me, you know, you got to do this. Like, he would always try to lead me. And looking back, I think he was trying to not have me make the same mistakes he did, like party. And he was always trying to get me to be clean and told me I had a shot, you know? And it was like never like you can't make it. It's like you can. Like, the way you fight, you got a really good style. You hit hard. You finish everybody. And he's like, you know, all these promoters know you got the juice, like you got Petro, that you'll go out there and get it in. That's what's important, is having good fights. And I remember I took that fight on short notice and I wasn't really training the way I should have been. And I wasn't taking time off because I was injured or nothing. I was just fucking off. And he beat me, and he should have beat me that night. But that was a big eye opener for me, is like, you got to train all the time. Like, you got to stay in shape all the time with your career, and all these opportunities aren't going to keep coming, and you got to be in shape and ready to take advantage of them. You know, there's no such thing as luck. You're either prepared or you're not. And that was a big for me.
Yeah. Roughhouse MMA had a really good reputation too. Like, if you fought somebody from their gym, whether you knew them or not, you knew you were fighting somebody tough, and Don absolutely falls into that category. And you make a quick turnaround. You fight Antonio Grant. You've got Drew Fickett on the card. You also got Rico Rodriguez.
Chris Lytle was ringside.
One more time.
Chris Lytle was ringside for that.
Was he really?
Yeah. I remember I that was back like when you had the internet and nobody could get on the internet. So they would all like go, you know, look up shit online or whatever. Uh-huh. And I remember going to a little community computer center, and there's this guy and his wife, and they were looking somebody up talking. And I walked by him. It was me. Like, they were looking me up on the internet. He was getting ready to fight me the next day. I didn't know much about him. I was like, I really didn't even look him up or whatever. I was just like, I was going to go fight, and I was fighting with Drew. So I was happy. And I got him. I think it threw the first punch. I smoked him with the first punch. And
yeah,
I remember looking at Chris Lytle and saying, man, like, you're a bit way bigger than I thought. I remember saying that to him. Like, he was way bigger than I thought. Like, cause in my mind, I was like, I was the biggest 70 pounder in the world. No one ever going to touch me. And then when I got
to, you were a big 70, you are a big 170 pounder though.
But then when I got around him, I was like, well, they don't look that small. you know, they look a little stronger and tougher than I thought, you know?
And, you know, from there you go back to Mexico, you fight Oscar Montero, you get a triangle and a Puerto Pensaco at the Mexican fight. What's that?
I was blacked out drunk for that fight.
Are you serious?
Swear to God. It was like my third fight, fourth fight in a row where nobody showed up. He didn't show up at the weigh-ins. And that there were supposed to be some fights in between there, where I would like go weigh in and my guy just wouldn't show up or whatever. And within like 7 months, there was several times where guys have just like shown up and I show up and the guy just doesn't come. So I was like, pretty ticked off. All my boys were fighting on the card. And we went over to this little pub, and there was like a really good cover band. They're playing Sublime. I thought it was on the radio. I was like, damn, bless. And it was a little, I was like, oh, I'm going to get a Tecate. And I drank one, and I thought, well, he might show up tomorrow. So I just stopped drinking. And I went in the morning, and I said, hey, is my guy here? And they said, no. I said, I'm going to come back at 10:30 or whatever. And they said, no. And I went back at noon, and they said, no. So I said, fuck it. He ain't coming. And I started getting hammered. And then I'm in the pool all day. Like, I didn't leave the pool. I was just drinking the pool, partying. And they come up to me and go, Seth, do you, your opponent showed up, you still want to fight? And I was like, yes. And Drew looks at me like a kid, like, he goes, Seth, you got to believe me. You don't drink like I drink. You can't stop drinking or you're going to get exhausted and crash. You're awesome. That's what he said. And bro, it was a great idea.
In theory.
Until that gate door closed. I'm getting ready to walk up the stairs. Everyone in the place knew I was drunk. The people at the fight were like, well, how many beers you had? I said, I had a few beers, bro. And he goes, well, you know, and I go, come on, man, look, I'm from Mexico. I'm from USA. This is USA versus Mexico. Like, come on, like, let me fight. And he goes, will you sign this? And I go, oh, because I'm going to come back and sue you guys. Yeah, sure, whatever. We're in Mexico. So I sign it, and I'm getting ready to go in the cage, and Drew looks at me and goes, Seth, I'll take your stand-up with anyone in the world, but you're drunk as fuck and your reaction time shit. You got to get this guy on the ground. And I was like, it's a bad deal, Seth. What were you thinking, you know? And I got in there, and I was bouncing back and forth thinking, like, well, if he knocked you out, you deserve it. Because you're a fucking idiot. And I got lucky and submitted him pretty quick. And went right back to the bar.
Yeah, you got to hand it to Drew. He gave you good advice.
That's what I'm saying. He's
the
man.
Under the circumstances.
Hey, he's a guy you always want there, because no matter what happens, he's just going to deal with the problem. He's not going to be like, oh, the problem's here. Oh, no. He's just like, oh, well, shoot. Yeah. I know you don't like to shoot, but you got to shoot now.
Yeah, don't walk a straight line.
It is very
the
simple.
The gig will be up. Just shoot in.
I'm proud of that fight, too. It's on my pro record. I'm proud of having a dumb decision like that work out. It could have went bad, and I'm not promoting young kids to do that, but it was a completely different community. The MMA community was so different back then.
Oh, forget it. Yeah. It's Mexico. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
You could fight an actual donkey.
I was going to say, it's like they usually, there's an old saying, nobody ever left a fist fight to go watch the band play, but they will go see the donkey show.
Absolutely. So we're coming up on the Ultimate Fighter. You make the Ultimate Fighter. And, you know, prior to that, you fight a couple really hard guys. James Warfield, you beat with a flying knee at the Phoenix, Arizona EVO, October 4th, 2008, James Warfield had cannons for fists. That guy hit hard.
I was supposed to fight Chad Reiner on a 2 weeks notice. Or Chad Reiner, and he pulled out, and they gave me that guy.
He's no joke.
I said, whatever, who cares? And I went out and got a win. Hey, I got to get ready for work, though, boys.
Excellent. You know what, Seth? We're going to bring you back, and we're going to go through your Ultimate Fighter UFC years. We really, really appreciate your time, man. Thank you.
Guys, that was awesome. It's 5:25, and I got to be working 5 minutes, so I got to get ready.
Okay.
Dude, awesome, thanks,
guys. You guys are awesome.
And thanks, brother.
Thank you, brother. Hey,
have a good one.
Yep.
Whoa, another one in the books, Mike. Seth Baczynski, he had to go to work, man. He bailed out on us, and I think we're just getting warmed up, but another good one in the books. A lot of cool stuff. That Southwest scene is certainly wild.
Man, there's so much talent that has come out of there. And like Joe Riggs is a wild man. Edwin Deweese is nuts. You know, Seth Baczynski, I mean, you just heard his story. And then there's Drew Fickett. And then hanging around in the wings, you know, as a, you know, beginning class fighter, you know, you've got
135 pound world champion. So it's like, it's an interesting scene, man. Like, well, we're going to keep scratching that itch. And you know, we're going to get as much out of Arizona as we possibly can. The Lally brothers. So yeah. Good. Yeah,
and my hat's off to Seth, because came very, very honest the whole interview through. I think it comes across. He wears his heart and his emotion on his sleeves, and
he fought that way too.
A lot of, yeah, definitely. And the Drew Figgins story is always, hey, we'll take more if you got him.
Well, you got to look at it this way. His professional record before he accidentally got onto the Ultimate Fighter, it was unimpressive. Like, on the surface level, if you look at it, it's somebody that's kind of struggling. And then, you know, in our second interview, which, you know, we'll probably get to him after the first of the year, when you see what he did on the big stage, he's got wins over Neil Magny and Matt Brown. Like, he found another gear. And it's somebody that isn't supposed to be where he's at, except he's fighting like higher than what he's supposed to. It's an inspiring story. It really is. Like, he's got an inspiring story.
Yep. I enjoyed it. I hope you do too. Please hit like, share, subscribe, make comments on iTunes, download it on iTunes. There's so much you could do to help us out. And so what are you doing? What are you waiting for? You know, come on.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Check out the folks on iTunes, Spotify, and all the podcasts.